Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Bentley, Judge Riley, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals on December 11. This is the matter rescheduled from October 30. We have one matter on this rescheduled calendar. It's file A231919, State of Minnesota versus Stephen Douglas Nelson. We are recording this proceeding, so no other recording is allowed. We also are live streaming, but the audio will be available on the judicial branch's website typically within 24 hours. But we do ask for that reason, too, the counsel do when they begin their comments to identify themselves for our record and whom you represent. I'm going to ask the There it is. I was just going to ask if I could see the clock. I couldn't see it till now. So can both counsel see the timer in the corner of your screen somewhere?
I cannot.
I can see it, Your Honor.
Okay. Perhaps counsel, are you searching to see if you can widen your screen or find a way to include that?
I opened full window and there it is.
Oh, very good. Okay, I was going to say otherwise we'll give you a little bit of a 2-minute warning if you couldn't, but now that you can see it, we do ask counsel to keep an eye on that as well. And with those comments, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Stephen Nelson. This appeal raises four separate grounds for reversing Mr. Nelson's convictions. To summarize, the violation of his right of confrontation with the witness, Mr. Ayers, the improper admission of the GPS evidence, ineffective assistance of counsel on four different grounds, and vindictive prosecution. I'll begin with the confrontation issue, barring any questions or direction from the court, by pointing out that this issue is framed around the conclusion to be drawn from the record that without Mr. Nelson having expressly consented to waiving his confrontation right with Mr. Ayers, this was a violation of that right, beginning with the fact that the district court did not make the required finding of unavailability before it simply granted the use of the out-of-court testimony. I would address the issue of invited error, which has been recently treated by our Supreme Court in Trifoletti.
Counsel, sorry, not to jump in so quickly, but I wonder if I could just narrow it to kind of where the dispute here is, make sure I understand your position. So as I understand the state's position, they're not arguing the unavailability issue. So it really is, they're saying even whatever set aside, even if he was available, that it was waived. Is that your understanding too? And I'll certainly ask them that.
It wasn't, Your Honor.
Okay.
I took that the state was disputing this issue on all grounds, but I still think that this court would have to see the district court following the proper procedure for allowing the out-of-court testimony by beginning with the finding of unavailability. But if that issue is considered settled, I'm happy to address the other aspects of this claim.
Thank you. So I'll have the state respond to that. Maybe then shifting kind of to the next question I had is, when we're talking about waiver here, is it your position that that Mr. Nelson had to personally waive it as opposed to his counsel waiving it, right?
Yes, on this particular issue, yes.
And so then, and here, then I'll stop here and let you continue. I just want to kind of focus you on at least where I'm focused, and you can tell me why I'm wrong. Let's just say that he didn't need to personally, that we disagree that he didn't need to personally waive it. Do you think the waiver of counsel would have been sufficient then in a world where there's no person, or are you also challenging the counsel's waiver of the right?
I am challenging the counsel's waiver of the right on two grounds, that it wasn't proper to do it without his client's express consent, and that it was ineffective assistance of counsel to do so. I do think that Trifoletti gets at this, though. Yes, the facts were somewhat different in that an objection was lodged by the defendant, but then the defendant eventually agreed to go ahead and let in the out-of-court testimony.
But just to
And
clarify, counsel, though, in Trifoletti, of course, the objection was quite strenuous. And in fact, the counsel made clear that the client did not favor either option that was provided. And only when the judge said, okay, your objection's noted for the record, where the defendant was forced to pick the two. But what I want to ask you is, isn't it true that we know that constitutional rights can be waived by conduct? And here we have it's pretty clear from the record, at least my reading of the record, is that your client's counsel favored reading the transcript from the beginning. In other words, it appears to me evident that counsel, and I think the state alludes to this in its briefing before as well, that there was a strategic reason to do so, and your client was present during that colloquy. Do we even need to get into anything other than that there was a waiver by conduct in this situation? So that in other words, it was your client's waiver, not the attorney's waiver. The attorney, prefaced it with the agreement or the understanding or the agreement to proceed that way, but your client remained quiet during that colloquy. Would that conduct not be a waiver?
I am going to rely on the fact that if that had been the case in Trifoletti, that this was always based on an objection, then the Trifoletti court would not have engaged in the invited error analysis, but they did. And the invited error had to be considered because the defendant eventually consented. But what Trifoletti found, and what I'm relying on here, is that when a defendant does not object, invited error will only be found when there's something in the record indicating that the defendant personally consented to the admission of this damaging out-of-court testimony. All of that is absent from this record. And I think that this issue must be looked at in light of what happened immediately preceding defense counsel's decision not to object to letting in this out-of-court testimony. The district court performed a full in-person waiver of Mr. Nelson's right to confront the medical doctor. That is how it was supposed to be done. Yet inexplicably, it turned around with absolutely no effort to inquire of Mr. Nelson to just letting in this out-of-court testimony from Mr. Ayers. That fails the Trifoletti test.
Counsel, did you cite any law in your brief that invited error is only present when a defendant personally, waives a right? I'm not aware of that, but
yes,
can you point me to a case?
Trifoletti at page 94. It says that
But just to clarify, though, in Trifoletti, though, the whole point was there was no invited error because he vigorously objected, through his attorney, vigorously objected to the two options that the court gave. Hence, there could not be an invited error. It just stopped at that point.
It doesn't change the rule of law that Trifoletti stated, that because this is such an important right, when the defendant does not object, invited error will only be found when he personally consents. That did not happen here, and that finding can be taken from page 94 of the decision. I'm relying on the rule of law, Trifoletti. I'm not attempting to say that the circumstances were different, but the framework of analysis here, the standard of review, is not met in this case.
But what about the issue? And in the briefs, both of you discussed the Eighth Circuit's Lee case, which I think you cite for the importance of the personal waiver. You know, that case talks about acquiescence and whether a defendant's acquiescence to a waiver may be sufficient. And I'm wondering why do you agree with that, with the way the Eighth Circuit kind of interpreted the right to confrontation clause here? And if not, why, or either way, was this or wasn't this an acquiescence? So, which is different, I think, from what you're talking about with Trifoletti and the invited, maybe it's not invited error in the same way, but it's at least an acquiescence to the waiver.
I do not think that Lee controls this case at all. It is
not that it controls, I should say. I don't agree. I don't think we're bound to follow it, why shouldn't we follow it?
Well, if I may continue, it is because Trifoletti controls here. And I'm relying on Trifoletti's statement that for Minnesota, they didn't analyze it ever in terms of acquiescence. They said that for invited error, There must be some indication that the defendant personally consented, and that is completely absent from this record. Trifoletti controls here, and that is what I am chiefly relying on here. And if I just can conclude by addressing the substantial harm that resulted from the admission of this evidence, the error was plain for the grounds I've stated. I would note that whether substantial rights affected, I've said, is equivalent to harmless error review, which the Supreme Court stated in Matthews. But here, for the harm, I'm relying on statements from the prosecutor in the record that in his opening, he told the jury that they were going to, quote, have to hear from Mr. Ayers. And at the original hearing in August 2021, as far as the strength of any other evidence, the prosecutor said that he could not go to trial without the GPS evidence. So the harm here is clear. Without the evidence from Mr. Ayers and the GPS evidence, their argument that would clearly have had an effect on the verdict and warrant relief here for the denial of Mr. Nelson's right. And I would lastly just dispute the claim that the record shows that this was an issue of strategy or tactics on the part of defense counsel. For the reasons I mostly cover in my ineffective assistance of counsel argument, I think the record demonstrates that defense counsel was not prepared for this trial. He did not get this transcript for the GPS, which was excluded for
Except
lack of
that
foundation.
He did have the transcript for Mr. Ayers, and there was a pretty good cross-examination of Mr. Ayers in that transcript from the first trial.
And I think
helped,
I covered
helped your client.
Well, I think I covered that in my brief about why the right to confrontation is so much more important than just what the witness says. There's all kinds of case law from Minnesota and the U.S. Supreme Court indicating that face-to-face in court is the key test of this. So the jury can judge the believability of the witness by his expressions, his cadence, how well he answers the questions. When you just put in a testimony transcript from an incredibly damaging accused, and in fact, the only witness who claimed to see the assault in this case, that is incredibly sanitized. Defense counsel's job was to confront this witness and not just put in an old, he wasn't prepared for trial. And I think the four grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel that I cite illustrate that.
Counsel, can I ask you about that? Our case law generally says that it's preferred that a record be developed when it comes to ineffective assistance of counsel. And my reading as well of the record doesn't make it quite so clear that these were other than strategy decisions, including the doctor and perhaps also this witness as well, the primary witness. And so why would we not simply, perhaps other than your first issue related to his comments during the opening statement, we can read that and consider that. But the other three, why would it not be more appropriate for us to indicate it's premature? There needs to be a post-conviction petition before the district court to develop the record.
The record in this case is abundantly clear. Just for example, on the GPS evidence, because defense counsel kept requesting it before the trial. He came on in the spring. He had a few months to get ready for this case. He made two or three requests for the GPS evidence. That was obviously his strategy. But then he just relented and did nothing about it. And that issue is accentuated by the transcript itself, which I was able to obtain and add to the record quite easily. It indicated clearly that Judge Hayes at the August 2021 hearing said that Agent Orr, the probation officer, was not enough to establish foundation for this scientific evidence. The state indicated it couldn't proceed to trial without it, and it dismissed. This was the result that defense counsel wanted. But he didn't do the one thing that would have been necessary to at least make the argument. And the presiding judge, Judge Hoffman, indicated that it may be law of the case. I need to see Judge Hayes's ruling. It never happened. So I think that everything you need for this ineffective assistance claim is right there in the record. And the cases that I'm relying on, in particular, Gruber,
Before you go into that, counsel, could you just clarify? Maybe I missed this. I'm trying to grasp the importance or lack thereof of the GPS. There's no dispute, as I understand it, that he was at the location where the assault occurred. It was a dispute as who committed the assault, correct?
Well, no, Your Honor. Again, defense counsel repeatedly sought to challenge the admissibility of the GPS evidence because he intended to dispute the location. It was only after he realized it was coming in that he decided not to dispute it. And that is reflective of the analysis and holding from the Nix case from the Supreme Court that I'm relying on, where defense counsel kept saying, I need these phone records. They're crucial to the defense, but he didn't do any investigation. He didn't get the records. That was ineffective assistance of counsel. And the important holding from Nix is that trial tactics are not reviewed under because they're defense strategy only after a complete investigation has clearly been done. This case is like Nix. No investigation was done at all. All he did was point out the importance of the GPS records by continually saying, I need the transcript, and he didn't utilize very simple procedures to go and get it. So when you combine that with the fact that he told the jury that he had to prove his client innocent in opening statement, that he waived Mr. Nelson's confrontation right to Mr. Ayers without asking him a single question to even indicate there was acquiescence or agreement. And then the fourth ground that I cited, which I'm going to have to say is again just that it was about not challenging Mr. Ayers' testimony, all indicate that these were matters that can be taken straight from the record, Your Honor. And that's why this is one of those cases that IAC can be reviewed in that fashion. I see I'm out of time.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel. I am Nick Colombo, Assistant Isani County Attorney, appearing on behalf of the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I agree. Those are the words of appellant's trial counsel after being asked his thoughts on the state's plan to introduce a transcript of the witness's prior testimony in lieu of his in-person testimony.
Counsel, if you want to just pause a moment, I lost the video. I just want to make sure that counsel for respondent is able to hear us. Counsel for respondent, why don't you keep your video on just so we make sure you stay with us? I do see your name on our list of participants.
Are you talking to me?
I am.
I'm the appellant, yes.
You are indeed. Thank you. I appreciate that. I just want to make sure you remain with us. Okay. Counsel for respondent, you may continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, appellant has now changed his position and challenges the introduction of that testimony, among other pieces of evidence that he now challenges. To allow the appellant to change course this late after he took full advantage of that trial testimony would be contrary to the fairness and the integrity of the proceedings against him. Now, I'll give a general overview of some of the arguments that appellant has made at this time. He offers several proposed arguments on why his conviction should be reversed, namely that his confrontational rights were violated, that the law of the case doctrine would require suppression of GPS evidence, that the trial court misstated the burden of or the trial counsel misstated the burden of proof, and that the prosecutor at trial acted vindictively in his pretrial charging decisions. And on top of this, he also argues that trial counsel was ineffective in many of these decisions as well.
Counsel, could just sorry to interrupt you. I just wonder if you could answer the question that I posed to appellant at the start about the issue of unavailability. What is the state's position as to whether that issue is still live on appeal? Do you challenge do we need to reach the question about whether he was unavailable, or is your, does this rise and fall on the issue of the waiver?
Your Honor, I certainly don't challenge the fact that, you know, there certainly isn't the best record in terms of making a determination of unavailability and whatnot. However, you know, I still do think there was some extensive record there to find that, you know, the witness that was in question was actually unavailable. I think there was some extensive discussion prior to when the parties ultimately made this decision to proceed. And I think that that discussion, not just prior to that, but I think also more towards the beginning of the case when the case had first started, points to evidence that there could be enough there to find that that witness was unavailable. However, Your Honor, I recognize that the record is not the clearest on that. And I do think that there was a waiver here based upon the statements made by trial counsel, you know, basically saying, I agree to proceeding this way. I agree to have this trial transcript admitted and read to the jury. And I think he even went so far as to actually, you know, make suggestions on how that should proceed.
Just to be clear, it's your position that regardless of whether he was available, the defense could have waived the confrontation right. So you know, the record is kind of muddy, as you say, as to whether or not, but is it your position that you could waive the right, let's say, even if he was available?
Yes, that is my position.
That was my question. You can continue.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Just to clarify, though, counsel, unlike with the doctor, there obviously was no personal waiver. So what is your interpretation of the law in terms of waiver by conduct? What conduct, and wouldn't it have to be conduct of the appellant himself, more so than the conduct or words of the attorney, to be considered a waiver by conduct?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Your Honor. And I'll start with some of the comments that were made by appellant's attorney here as well in terms of Trifoletti. I mean, I've read Trifoletti, and I simply do not see the reading that appellant counsel has made here. I don't think I see anything in there that says that there has to be personal waiver. Now, it does say, I believe, that you know, the party should consent, or it should be affirmatively requested here. But I don't see anywhere in that case that says that it has to be done personally by the defendant himself. Now, Your Honor, I will also point to, I think I cited this in my brief, but it is an unpublished case, but it's State versus Ramon. And I think something, some similar arguments were made there in terms of personal waiver. And in that case, the court cited several different federal level cases that seem to suggest that defense counsel in a criminal case can waive his client's Sixth Amendment right of confrontation. And I think even one case goes so far as to say, so long as they do not dissent from the attorney's decision. Now, we can see here that, you know, the client was present when these discussions were happening. He didn't say anything to his defense counsel at the time. Now, I think, you know, appellant counsel also mentioned, you know, that, and you, Your Honor, mentioned this as well, that there was a waiver for the doctor just prior to this. And I actually think that that's not entirely helpful for appellant's case, because I think that shows then that the defendant was aware specifically of the rights that he had under the confrontation clause. They had just gone over that. So I think that makes it even less plausible now for him to argue that, well, I didn't know I had this right of confrontation. You know, I didn't know I had the right to cross-examine this witness today. And I think that that's actually not helpful in this case for him. Now, I also point to
another... Could you respond, counsel, too, that about invited error? I think it was Mr. Marvigli made reference also to Trifoletti, that in order for, if I understood his argument, that in order for an invited heir to be present or an issue here, it would have required the personal statement or waiver of the appellant himself. Do you believe invited heir is present? And if so, what's the law that would apply here for invited heir?
Oh, Your Honor, I do believe that invited error is present here. Like I just alluded to in Trifoletti, I don't see the same reading that appellant's counsel has made there. I don't think it says anything about there having to be personal waiver of the defendant here. And just as I mentioned, you know, that State versus Ramon case, you know, even kind of suggests that as well, through all the cases that it cites and through all the federal cases that it mentions there. So Your Honor, I don't think that the law supports a finding for personal waiver. I'll even point to cases such as State versus Caulfield, which I've cited in my brief, which, you know, says that the right of confrontation is one of the rights that it's not among those rights that require an affirmative waiver in writing or on the record. So that's a Minnesota Supreme Court case even saying that, you know, for the right of confrontation, at least, we don't need an affirmative waiver in writing or on the record. And I think, you know, we can clearly see that through the record here, you know, at least at the very minimum, implicitly, that there was a waiver to such right based upon the trial counsel's decisions, by how he used the evidence that was actually introduced. I mean, it was clearly, as the court has alluded to in these arguments, a part of his trial strategy. I think, you know, the defense even raised a alternative perpetrator defense. And it seems like everything that he was using this testimony for was geared towards arguing that defense. He was trying to say that
Colombo, Mr. Colombo. So with regard to invited error, the case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court, Benton Carradine, is that the invited error doctrine does not apply to plain errors that involve substantial or substantive rights. Do you agree with that? And how does that impact your analysis?
Your Honor, I do not agree with that. And actually, I
with the court when they wrote that, or what don't you agree with?
No, sorry, Your Honor. I don't agree with that reading of the law. So I think that Trifoletti itself, you know, kind of answers this question, because that court, the Supreme Court there, explicitly contemplated the invited error doctrine applying here. And as, you know, counsel mentioned, this that too was a confrontation right case, a substantial right case. So it seems that the Supreme Court has, you know, highly suggested that you can, in fact, make an invited error doctrine argument when it comes to the confrontation clause. So I think I would rely on that. And Your Honor, also,
Can I just clarify something in terms of the waiver again, Mr. Colombo, your position? And when I look at that Ramon case too, the analysis strikes me as more of one of conduct again. There was silent, the reference, I think, in the decision was silence, and as opposed to any overt conduct. We typically see that in the cases, for instance, when one absents themselves from a courtroom because of disruptive conduct, for instance. So isn't it true that at least in Minnesota, the presumption is a constitutional waiver has to be personal, but it can be done by conduct? So again, it's not the attorney who's waiving it. It's perhaps in a case like here or in Ramon, it's a combination of what the attorney says and the silence or acquiescence. Would that be a fair or an accurate description, you think, of the law of waiver by conduct?
Your Honor, I think I would agree to that in substantial part. I think a big part of my argument here is the conduct, you know, and the silence on the record from defense counsel or defendant himself in terms of allowing this evidence in. And as I mentioned, I think it's very clear here that that's exactly what happened, that, you know, there was a complete acquiescence to this. And I will say, however, that I do think that there is some support for a defense counsel waiving such rights on behalf of their clients. And I think I'll refer to that one federal case that was cited in Ramon as well. You know, I mean, it seems clear that, you know, as long as the defendant doesn't dissent from the attorney's actions, then it should be fine. And here, I think the record is clear that he did not. He didn't say anything about this evidence being allowed into the record. He didn't object. He didn't ask to speak to his counsel about that. And I'll also point out that this is all in the context of he had just been apprised of his confrontational rights with the previous witness as well.
Can I ask you your view on kind of the role that the plain error, kind of our review under plain error, plays into this? You know, because he didn't object, it seems as though the parties agree that this is reviewed for plain error. So what does that mean, or how does that influence how we decide this? I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here, I think, is the error piece. Was there an error, let alone? So I'm just curious for your position on, does that change our analysis, or should we reach the error question that we're talking about, regardless of whether or not it's then plain?
Yeah, so I think how the plain error would work here is, assuming, you know, taking the waiver aside, is that, and I think a State versus Goals kind of and I cite that in my brief. I think that provides a good framework here for how that can be evaluated here. In that case here, I think it talks about the invited error doctrine as it relates to the plain error doctrine. And there it notes, you know, that, you know, Goles had not only failed to object to the testimony, he also developed and expanded the evidence that was controverted in his own testimony. And he also used it in the closing statements that he had as well. So we can see from that case, I think that, you know, what the court looked at was that, well, while, you know, through the plain error lens, you know, what the defendant did was actually, you know, expand upon the evidence that was brought in. He used it to his benefit. And that's exactly what happened here as well. I think that's very analogous to the situation we have here. And I'll also note in Goles that he also used that those statements that were introduced to go towards his heat of passion defense that he was making as well, which is also similar to here, as he was trying to make a alternative perpetrator defense. So, Your Honor, I think the court in that case found, you know, that, well, you know, while acknowledging the plain error exception, it was saying that, you know, defense counsel had used it to its benefit, therefore he cannot take advantage of it. Therefore, it does not fall under the plain error exception at all. So I think that's how the court kind of dealt with it in Goles. I think I see a lot of similarities between Goles and this case as well.
Thank you. I realize you're running out of time. Judge Slater, do you mind? I have one more question. I know that he's, do you mind if I?
You certainly may.
Thank you. I just wonder if you could address, just jumping quickly to the vindictive prosecution question, and just looking at the record, I'm just wondering, and maybe this is, you know, I don't know if there's any basis in the record to understand what happened here as to why the attempted second degree murder charge wasn't charged earlier, or what, just, you know, how can we understand the record of like what happened here? It seems kind of interesting that after a number of years of having this case, that all of a sudden you get a second degree murder charge right before trial. What happened there?
Well, Your Honor, I think that, you know, what happened there is not necessarily, you know, a question that we have to reach here based upon some of the case law that I mentioned in my brief. I mean, I think the case law is pretty clear that the state has a lot of latitude with pretrial charging decisions. The state's able to do that. I think a lot of the cases that were cited too by appellate counsel were more geared towards, you know, mistrials or cases where the appellant was appealing and then the state added a charge as a result of that. So, Your Honor, I guess we don't necessarily need to reach that question here based upon the case law. And I think that, you know, there may be a lot of questions. However, the state has a lot of...
What do you make of their argument that that this was a response to the motion to suppress the GPS evidence that had, you know, kind of caused the first trial to get derailed?
Sure. I mean, Your Honor, I don't think there's a lot of support in the record to support that contention. You know, honestly, you know, if that were to be, I just don't think there's anything that supports that. You know, it seems to be, from my reading, coincidental. And I don't think there's, you know, really any plausible reason why the state would even do that in response to him filing that motion. It doesn't seem to make sense to me that would be something that would be responded to as a result of the defense filing that. So I think that's what I would say to that.
Thank you.
Very well. And counsel, Mr. Mayor Bigley, you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal and you may begin.
Thank you. I'll just begin by going straight to Trifoletti. The language that I quoted on page 94, the Supreme Court said that it had recognized the doctrine of invited error for decades. It said that it is done when the party consented or affirmatively requested the evidence. But the example it took was from the Weigold case all the way back in 68, which held that when it is a defendant who affirmatively consented on the record to closing, well, to giving up his public trial right, this is what invited error was. That's why I'm relying on Trifoletti. And I would agree with the question posed that when it comes to fundamental rights, a right such as the right to confrontation can be waived by conduct. There's plenty of case law on that, but it can't simply be waived by the attorney. And I think this issue has to be examined in tandem with the fact that the issue of the medical doctor was treated so carefully. I mean, if anything, once the attempted murder charge was brought, the extent of Mr. Turner's injuries was not a significant factual issue. It was who did it. So if they're going to get a waiver on the medical doctor for evidence that is less impactful on the top count, then it needed to be done for Mr. Ayers. And I would just also like to address the vindictive prosecution issue by stressing that I am relying on the Bordenkircher example most of all, where a new, more severe charge is brought shortly before trial. The Bordenkircher court found there was no evidence of vindictiveness from that record because the prosecutor made a plea offer. He offered him something less substantial and punitive than the new charge he brought before they went to trial on it. That didn't happen here. This attempted murder charge was brought the day after Mr. Nelson filed his motion to suppress the GPS evidence again through his attorney, which again indicates the importance of this issue and defense counsel's failure to follow through on it. So in this case, the appearance of vindictiveness, which is what can be drawn from the record both in Bordenkircher and Blackledge, which I'm relying on, there couldn't be a more plainer picture painted here. And because the prosecutor did not make a single offer for settlement after that charge was filed, I think on May 23rd of 2023, that is why there can be vindictive prosecution under Bordenkircher. I would just
what
also
do you make of then, just in response, you know, it seems to me like your argument turns on the fact that it came the day after the GPS suppression motion was filed. Is that right? And then the second piece is how does that show, like, give us an indication of vindictiveness?
Well, that's what created the issue, the timing of it and the dramatically higher severity of the charge. When, yes, this prosecutor had been sitting with this case for almost 2 years at that point. But I think it's the fact that no plea bargaining was engaged in. You see, prosecutors are not allowed unfettered discretion in charging. And I'm relying on the Bordenkircher's almost admonition to prosecutors that if they're going to move the goalposts at the last minute and bring a more severe charge, they need to take part in good faith plea discussions at the very least. And that didn't happen here.
So what then about the Goodwin case kind of discusses Bordenkircher, and, you know, in that case, I read it to say that just because a defendant doesn't take an earlier plea doesn't mean that the state can't, you know, charge up again. So why is this different than Goodwin?
This isn't about an earlier plea. There was an earlier plea offer, which Mr. Nelson rejected. I'm talking about what happens once the prosecutor brings the more severe charge. It is at that point, in order to avoid the appearance of vindictiveness, that a prosecutor is advised to engage in plea discussions. I'm taking that directly from Bordenkircher, which the prosecutor did in Bordenkircher. Thus, no vindictiveness was found. That wasn't the deal here. There was a week or two to go on trial. The prosecutor did not offer any discussion. He was getting his GPS evidence. This is as plain a case of vindictive prosecution as it could be. The prosecutor stated in the record in August of 2021 how essential that GPS evidence was. And he did this right after, the day after the motion to exclude it was made again. I would just conclude by pointing out, I apologize earlier for saying I had brought three grounds of ineffective assistance. I brought four grounds for the appeal, but there were three grounds of ineffective assistance. I missed up those numbers, but I would just again conclude by asserting that this record establishes enough of a record for all of those to be reviewed and for IAC to be found. I'm out of time. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today, as well as your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue an opinion within 90 days. You each have a good day and Merry Christmas to you as well, since we're feeling Christmassy these days.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Your Honor.